Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Right, Achtung, Achtung, hello there. As you notice, James Holland, not here, or is he that side? I don't know. James isn't with us, and I'm here leaning against the danger keep-off barrier at the arena at Bovington Tank Museum, at the Tank Museum here in sunny, beautiful Dorset. What a gorgeous day. And what is today? Well, it's Tiger Day Eve. That's what it is. It's the night before Tiger Day when Santa Tiger wraps up all your presents and puts them at the end of your bed. Because here's the thing about We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Regular listeners, you know this. I know this. We downplay the tiger because there's just too much tiger porn, basically, out there in the world of tank appreciation. Too many of you are too hot for the tiger. So James and I resist. Maybe we've basically got tiger envy. Maybe, you know, the case we've made for the Sherman and the Cromwell along the way. In the end, when you're stood next to that sort of dusky yellow big cat, maybe some of it we're just overcompensating because ours is smaller. I don't know. Anyway, the point is, we're back at the Tank Museum where, if you're a regular listener, was one of the first places we ever came. And I'm going to be talking to David Willey, who we spoke to last time we were here as well, about Tiger Day. It is fantastic the museum is here. Here's the thing. The museum, at the start of the pandemic, had 200 things in its gift shop online. Now it has 4,000 because there's an appetite, apparently, for making scale models of tanks out there. I have no idea about any of that. I couldn't relate to any of that at all. I've bought a load of stuff from here in the last few months. Anyway, I'm gonna go see David, and he's going to tell us about Tiger 131, because the focus, of course, is Tiger 131, which is the only running tiger tank in the Tiger Mark I in the world that they have here at the museum, and that in many ways is sort of how the museum really laid out its case for itself as a collection in the last couple of decades, that they had a running tiger, they used lottery funding to get that going. It's an interesting piece of heritage. It's like a teaching tool. It's not exactly a piece of living history, but a great deal of the museum's philosophy is tied up in the tank. So I'm going to go listen to David, and he'll tell us of the torturous story of where was this tiger tank captured? Because apparently there's some dispute about where it was, because there were two encounters on the same day, blah, blah, blah. The Rimi who collected it, bringing it back, sticking it in Horse Guards Parade in order to scare the bejesus out of people, which is the only reason I can think they possibly did that. And then its eventual progress via Chertsey and the tank factory and being an R&D exhibit, basically, to becoming an exhibit here and then becoming a running exhibit here. So there's lots to talk to David about. If you've ever run into David, who watched him online, because he's done a load of online stuff during the pandemic from here, David can talk. So that's why James isn't here, because otherwise we'd enter some sort of parallel three-dimensional talk-off where all hind legs on all donkeys in all of Dorset would be sadly, you'd end up with two-legged donkey monstrosities dragging themselves around, having had all their hind legs talked off by the three of us. So I'm here as a sort of talk firewall to prevent an outbreak of too much talk. So it's the Tank Museum. It's Tiger Day tomorrow. It's Tiger's Day Eve. I'll be talking to David Willey. I hope you enjoy this. He's a fascinating guy, and it's an amazing story. And it is brilliant to be back at this museum that is 100% armoured fighting vehicle catnip for the likes of me. And you too, I expect. Right, well, I'm down now in the main display hall floor, stood next to Tiger 131, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined by David Willey. Hello, David.
Hi there, welcome back.
It's a great pleasure to be back. And of course, you were one of our earliest, I think our first location trip we did with We Have Ways helped us get started. But Tiger 131, I know I've done a thing where I say tiger, 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 Hitler like it because it's big and all that. And I've kind of I'm nervous of the sort of fetishizing this tank too much. But here we are, it's the day before Tiger Day. We'll let that go. We'll fill our boots with tiger stuff. this tank, I was struck, we've just watched your talk in depth about this tank in particular. The thing I was really struck by right from the start is even in the design of this, this tank's design takes into account to an extent how resource poor the Germans are. Yet here it is, this great big monstrous machine.
Yeah, it's funny. It all comes together with your point you just made about not going overboard on the Tiger. We have a major issue with the Tiger is that for us at the Tank Museum, we've got a Tiger Day. We run the only Tiger 1 left in the world of six of the left. So this is the only one working at the moment, as it were. And yet, at the same time, the rest of the time, I'm standing here saying, but remember, there was only 1,300 of them. Compare that with the Shermans. So when everyone's coming out with the, we're part of the problem, in a way, by making the Tiger more impressive than perhaps it was, or giving that impression, at the same time, I have a tendency, if I'm not careful, I can go too far the other way, which is, oh, ignore it, it wasn't that. When, in fact, of course, when it comes on the battlefield, we're looking at a vehicle that it is such a leap forward in terms of thickness of armour, of gun power, of, you know, for at least a year or so, potentially what it could do on the battlefield with very little fear of the enemy, meant it was such a huge step forward if we look in overall tank design. But immediately, I want to qualify myself to saying, actually, but there weren't that many of them, so it doesn't make a big difference. Yes, you see, I mean, so constantly it's that dilemma.
Yes, you're sort of all, it's sort of a snakes and ladders thing when talking about the Tiger, isn't it? Because, I mean, after all, the year of the Tiger tank is 1943, really, isn't it? That's the year where it has dominance on the battlefield. There's nothing to match it. 1944, I mean, the thing that's striking about this is this is captured, this is 131. When's this captured?
So it's in April of 43.
Right.
So you're looking at, you see, the thing is, the first ones are going out late 42.
Yep.
They have this disastrous start because they've got, you know, like any new bit of kit, it's got a lot of teething trouble.
Yeah.
So that's not unique to the Tiger.
It's a leap forward. So.
But here they've got things they're learning on the job, but they go out to the east, a couple of them, or six of them go out to Eastern Front. They have major problems there. These are being built. Hitler's behind the program. So you've got this issue of him constantly saying, so what's going on next? You know, he wants to be updated.
Yeah.
What's happening with the Tigers? And as I was mentioning earlier, you know, one of the things that amazes me about this is a Tiger that comes out of the factory in February, is captured in April in North Africa.
Yeah.
The unit that's being formed to crew it, the CO, is put in charge of it literally and told the following week they're going to be moving off to Tunisia.
Yes.
So one of the other points that not only is the technology new and bound to go through some problems, but a lot of the crews that have been put in these tanks, certainly in the early days, have, you know, they are just new to it as well, so they're learning on the job.
Yeah.
So I speculate that might be one of the reasons why Tiger 131 is captured in the state it is, because again, whether the crew, you know, the guy who from Remy, who's sent out to help recover the tank, one of the things he mentions, he thinks the engine may have overheated. Are we looking at a crew in this tank who, basically, if you've got a brand new car and it's 2 months later, you're going to be driving that car a lot more than these guys ever have the chance to drive this tank?
Yes.
Brand new vehicle, 2 months later, do you know what every button does?
Yeah.
Can you really get the best from it? Do you see? So I still think there's a lot of suppositions that we sometimes go through with, you know, oh, it was such a powerful tank and weren't they the best and didn't they have the cool uniforms, everything. Take it apart, I think the story's a little bit more subtle.
Well, and also, I mean, there's a lot of, I'm struck by actually how much damage there is in this tank. I mean, especially at the back, the all the engine assembly and the exhausts and stuff are smashed up. The two big exhaust cowlings, that's what these are, aren't they?
Yeah, they're protectors, so you just basically didn't touch them, or they get hot anyway.
And they're punctured and shattered and crushed. And you know
stowage bin on the back.
It's a bin, isn't it? That's right. Stowage bin on the back is similarly damaged. Now, you know, in the telling of the story, it's always that there's a 6 pound around that jams under the mantlet and stops the turret from rotating, which is also good enough reason to bail out of a tank because you're no longer you can't shoot at anybody anymore effectively. So you could, you know, but. This damage suggests you know, it's not just the one £6 around. They're actually in a bit of, they're in dire straits, this crew.
So if you look at the photographs when it's first captured, so the loader's hatch, which was subsequently replaced, is shattered. It must have been in the open position to be hit.
Yeah.
So when you see the damage that's done to that, if you were in that space behind it, no doubt, you know, as I was saying earlier, it probably gave you a bit more than a headache.
Yeah.
If you go into the driver's position, the early photographs when it was first captured, there's quite a bit of an indentation and smashed metalwork above your head.
Yeah.
So, and we're around the rear of the tank, you can see at the moment, so this is almost certainly blast damage from high explosives that have gone through things like the FIFA air filters, etc. So what you're looking at when you're seeing this is, what we don't know for certain is when that tank was in combat, and I still hope, as you know, someday, whether a set of letters or something from the crew, you know, something does emerge, I can't help but feel that maybe the crew were wounded or certainly deeply shocked by the action they've just gone through.
Well, one of the other things is they've been told this, I expect they've been told this tank's indestructible and impermeable to any anti-tank kit they might run into. It certainly was in 1942, but the six-pounder is a widespread weapon by 1943, isn't it? And so maybe they take a considerable knock, the turret jams, and they think, oh, it isn't indestructible after all. I'm out of here.
Yeah,
again, lots of conceptions you have to sort of chip away at. Although they're steely Germans, and although they're a Schwerepanzer outfit, they're still blokes. And just as you said in your talk, that when a British guy first saw it, I shit my fucking pants, whatever it is. It goes the other way round too, doesn't it?
And I just think go through, look at the history, and we've got it here in the museum, but right from the worst first ones to the last ones, you have got to be a very dedicated crew to stick in a tank that is immobile.
Yep.
You've got to have nerves of steel, because again, if you look at the photographs when it's captured, the British soldiers are really close and up around it.
Yeah.
So the idea, again, if you're in an immobile vehicle or someone stalled the engine, again, read all the accounts.
Yeah.
The first urge is to abandon the vehicle fairly quickly.
Yeah. Well,
because you're just waiting to go up in flames.
The next one's going to actually kill us all. So.
And that's true. I don't care what you know, for any side. Look at the British in Normandy. Yeah. Okay. Sort of, you know, when you bail out, etc. The fact that some of the tanks were recoverable, you know, so when we go to things like Goodwood, the fact that loads of those tanks that the guys have abandoned are very quickly put back into action. But if something's come through or something stopped you, the first urge is your life is still more important than kit.
I mean, I'm loath to criticise. After all, it's like the you know, American paratroopers were fined if they used their reserve unnecessarily. Well, who's to judge that? Your pay got docked. Obviously, this tank, when it was first seen on the battlefield, this is a massive culture shock, because there's a Mark III over there, isn't there? And just the sort of, it's a Mini Moak and an Audi Q5 in terms of
back to this, trying to sort of compare and contrast and everything, but 10 centimetres of frontal armour on this, when you only look at the time, we're still coming out there, you know, there's photographs of things like Valentine's, Crusaders and everything passing by, a knocked out Tiger. The 88mm gun that could quite effectively knock out pretty much every British tank on the battlefield from about 2 kilometres away. So there is no denying that this is a step change in tank design and used well is a real difference, you know. And if you read their early accounts, the troops coming back, yes, they're full of, we can't get the spare parts, yes, we can't get this, we can't, or they're breaking down all over the place, etc. But at the same time, they are absolutely delighted by the fact that they can be on the battlefield. And if you read that, you know, how they're supposed to use them at 45 degrees to the enemy, etc., you know, you're almost in some circumstances impervious to enemy fire.
Yeah.
So it means what they talk about is, tactically, you can move across, you can go places on the battlefield that any other person will be thinking, well, hang on, let's skirt around the edge here, let's not do this. These guys go straight at you across, you know, because they just know whatever's being fired at them, very little chance early on it's going to penetrate.
Yeah.
So it's this, again, we come back to, you know, this is a very powerful bit of kit in the right hands with everything going in the right direction at the same time. The key one I come back to all the time is, but the chances of you as an Allied tank soldier bumping into one is still remarkably thin.
Yeah.
Because there's not that many of them out there.
Well, and most of them, the majority of, unless I'm wrong, are deployed on the Eastern Front anyway.
Yeah, so you're, and even there, again, statistically, this is a pinch in the ocean compared to the number of T-34s,
and
KVs, etc.
It's an upgun Mark IV that's doing the donkey work.
Yeah, or Sturmgeschütz later on, you know. So it's what's the typical. Back again, actually, we're at the Tank Museum, we always talk about tanks, but tanks aren't even typical on some of the battlefields. Yeah. So, you know, back to actually, you know, some infantry go through most of the war and don't see tanks that often. Yeah. So it's another one where we tend to sort of put the laser light on what we're interested in or what the story in our area is, but most of the rest of the day, actually, you know, it's about artillery, it's about infantry, it's about the blooming boredom of warfare.
Yeah.
A tank going past is, you know, sometimes quite a major event.
Yes, which is why it gets written up.
Yeah.
Of course, it's why then attention's focused on it. When the British get hold of this, they ship it back to Chertsey, to the tank factory, and they, what do? They take it apart and put it back together. I mean, did they find a manual with the
they don't actually, they've captured documents that actually help, and we've actually published years ago, there was a HMSO book which is basically the British intelligence summaries, and we're about to republish that, so keep an eye on our website.
Will do.
That book actually shows what we knew about the Tiger from press cuttings, etc. When we've got the captured tank, what they're doing first of all is they're looking at it, are there points of vulnerability? So some are taken off for firing trials, so when they've got other Tigers, this one is stripped pretty much. Is there things we can learn, to whether it's to emulate, to copy, to understand a difference? So it's hard sometimes to say, did we actually pick up anything from this Tiger?
Well, that was going to be my next question. What is there to learn apart from we need to get a 17 pounder onto a medium tank hastily?
Yeah, so we've already going down that route.
Figure that out anyway.
Yeah, so a 17 pounder is no bad thing. We can, so if you look at Tiger 131, one of the first things they do is they film it driving around for a recognition film.
Yep.
So it's, this is how we identify this chaps, which is still a key, you know, in modern warfare as well. So we don't have what's called blue on blues. We're not firing our own, our allies. We know, you know, when we should be panicking, etc. So that idea, it's filmed that way. I don't think that when you read the reports, there's anything they slap their thighs and go, my goodness, we never thought of that. Let's copy this chaps. But what it is doing is influencing that idea of the gun and armour race is one we need to be further up that chain on, because we are either going to have to get the 17-pounder or later the 77mm that goes on the Comet with enough penetration to make a difference on the battlefield.
Yeah.
So that is a key outcome. We know we have got an issue. And the other one is just basic tactics, which is, okay, we fired at the front, we fired at the side, you've got a 6-pounder chaps, have a go at the side, you're pretty much on for that.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of what you might call the firing trial experience.
Well,
it's
let the tank come on to you then. I mean, on a recent podcast, we looked at one of the war diaries for Arnhem, and it's the HQRA report, and he's saying, why did we lose our 17-pounder and 6-pounder? It's hard to say, but here's how the infantry perform, and the infantry keep forgetting that they think you've got to bring the gun to the tank, whereas in fact what you've got to do is get the tank to come to the gun. Now obviously you can read that and think, oh well, yeah, that makes it, but that we're talking about lots of nerve here, and lots of nerve required to get a Tiger to come into your anti-tank screen and your trap and wait for him to be at the point where you're shooting into his side. He's effectively flanked you for you to be able to do that. So there's quite a lot of this, that's requiring quite a lot of cool nerve training, planning, and, you know,
lines I said earlier is when I've talked, I have the great privilege here, and, you know, they're getting thinner on the ground all the time, but if you ever, and I say this to everyone, get a chance to talk to a World War II veteran,
yeah,
you know, firstly, tip your hat to them sort of thing, and then that idea that what they sometimes say, the thing that fascinates me is that reading accounts, talking to veterans, everyone had a unique experience of the war.
Yep.
So you do have to be a little bit careful that we don't sort of make everybody's experience the same.
Yes, yes.
And Ken Tout, who I'm not sure if you've read his books
or the privilege of met,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Now Ken's still going, and one of the things he said in Normandy, once they'd worked out how to deal with heavy armour, they had a level of confidence in their unit,
yeah,
which is hard perhaps for us looking back as if, oh, we were all in terrible thin Shermans all the time, or Cromwell's, you know, the German Tomica cranker. It's hard to take that on when, in fact, these guys, no, some of them were bloody good at their job.
Yeah.
They pick it up, they've got balls of steel, and they work out the way of dealing with this.
Well,
because they've got to.
They've got to, and they call their Charlie tank up in the troop who comes up and they save the tigers up for him.
I mean, so they do that. So Ken's of that unit with, you know, as you're going in with Joe Eakins, etc. So you see that side of it. The other side I was amazed as well, people like Reg Spittles, when he was the corporal, he's quite often in what was considered the point or the lead tank in a Cromwell. One of the things we got him talking to modern soldiers, and they all asked him, what's the first round you carry when you're the lead tank? He ended up arguing smoke. Because when you saw that boxy shape in the hedge up ahead, he knew it was pointless him thinking, I'm going to do all this.
That one on him, yeah.
He put smoke, and what's the first thing those guys in that tank are either going to be doing is, number one, I can't see bugger all.
Yeah.
Number two, is this the symbol for an air attack? So all of a sudden, I'm going to be waiting for the, here comes the fighter bombers and everything.
Yes.
And that may lead them to back off or expose themselves, so he's so got...
And by moving, confirm that they're there. I mean, and they confirm that they've seen you and that you're a step ahead of them.
So right. That idea that he was... So this idea, these guys are working out these tactics on the hoof, and you'll find different tank crews come to different conclusions, they work out different ways of doing that. But I thought Reg's one there was brilliant, because it was literally the young soldiers thinking, because so often in an engagement, historically, they've done all the analysis, it's whoever gets the first aimed round off first, and the quickest in many ways.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That sense of, actually, if we can disrupt you doing that, we've got a second chance. And if you're the point tank...
Gosh, that's fascinating.
If you're the point tank, you are likely to be the one. You know, they might be waiting for you to go past, because we're going to, you know, the usual one, you start the back of the column or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So some of those things. And I just think, and again, listening to how these different people... We can read a manual, we can see what's said there. Listen to what the blokes themselves say. And there's plenty of those beautiful, you know, memoirs out there.
Well, Ken's account of that attack, the Wittmann encounter.
Yeah.
That they're putting all that. Everyone with the 75 millimeters are putting their HE onto the Tigers to suppress them, so that they can get the Firefly to bear. I mean that you know, when you think about it, that's obviously what you do. And it also says that the Sherman with the 75 millimeter is not powerless in that encounter. It's actually crucial to it.
Yeah,
you know, and it's teamwork and all that.
Yeah,
sort of thing.
They do, and when they're doing that as well, if you read, you see the year after the war ended, the Northants Yeomanry write up a little book, and in there that engagement is written about, with the fact it's Joe Eakin's tank and Stan Boardman are knocking out those three targets in a row, which is why I get a bit, okay, there's confusion. As I said it earlier, we have to learn that we can reinterpret and relearn history. But there's no doubt it's in that war diary. It's written immediately after the war that is what happened on that day, which is why I get fed up of all these modern people coming on with all this bollocks about, oh, no, it was over there. It was all this other stuff and everything. Listen to what those blokes said at the time.
And also, they weren't writing that at the time with the Wittmann myth
nothing.
In mind.
Absolutely. Joe Eakin said that.
That
you know, it's years later before he finds out, you know, that it's a guy in a black uniform in a country that he shouldn't be in. You know,
exactly.
So I, anyway, I, you know, I'm starting to rant. But the point about...
We like the red meat.
that issues is, but that's why, again, I would say, so again, there's a Tiger tank. These guys have to learn how to fight it. It's a war of national survival. These guys have not got the option of saying, okay, we'll pack up and we're going to leave and we're not going to do this sort of thing. They have got to find ways around it. So whether that is deception, let's fire smoke, let's imagine there's going to be planes coming over, you guys be better getting out of here. Let's discretion, let's back off.
Discretion.
Let's get
often.
Out of the way, know, so that let's not, we don't have to take these guys on at this moment. Let's start finding our way because that guy is very quickly, once he knows he's been located, he is going to be waiting for the other blokes to work their way around the rear. We'll keep a couple of vehicles here so that they'll keep them engaged, keep them facing forward. Your mate's going left flank or right flank where the armour's thinner, and that guy sitting there is going to be thinking, like, I know this is going to be coming at some point soon. How long do I give it before I decide I've got to back out or manoeuvre again?
Right, we've got to take a break now, unfortunately. I mean, I could just talk to David forever. He knows everything. We'll see you in a tick. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. I'm talking to David Willey at the Tank Museum, the curator of the Tank Museum, to myself and for you. How fantastic is that? Here we go. Now, to change the subject completely, restoration. Famously, this is the only running Mark I in the world. You centre the day around Tiger Day. It's a massive attraction. You've got your platinum members here, whatever you call them, and the museum has adapted and survived incredibly nimbly to deal with the pandemic and the challenges it's offered. And I've bought an awful lot of gear from your model shop. When you're restoring a vehicle like this, what I'll compare it to something in my professional life. There's a venue in Leeds called the City Varieties, which is where they used to film the good old days. It's a music hall, a proper Victorian music hall, and it evolved from four buildings, I think pubs that were all next door to each other, that gradually the owner bought more of them and knocked through and built a theatre inside the building. And they did a massive English heritage restoration on it that I think finished sort of 7 or 8 years ago. It's beautiful, but they had to decide which year they were restoring the Leeds City Varieties to. And I think they picked a year out of the hat, like 1898, whatever. But obviously they had to put a modern PA in, a modern light, but they got an unobtrusive modern PA and unobtrusive modern lights. And then they had to decide how they were going to get wheelchairs into the building. So you've got this beautifully, perfectly restored, but there's an enormous glass lift on the outside of the building and a hole punched into the building to get, which is fine and fair enough. What year do you pick? Do you put a wheelchair lift in as analogies? You know, how do you, because if the point is having it running, surely what you do is stick a modern engine in it so it's reliable, it starts every time, it won't catch fire and destroy your exhibit, you know, and all those sort of things. How do you make those decisions?
So we are officially what they call an accredited museum with a designated collection. So there's standards that we have to try and work to, and there's industry, what I would call advice.
Yeah.
And the ethic really is where you can save originality, you should. There are things that cross that. So sometimes we're looking at materials that are now banned. We've got asbestos or whatever.
Of course,
you just can't say, oh, well, you know, it's original asbestos. Let's keep it there. Yeah. Sorry about your lungs, chaps, who are working on it. You know, that you just can't do that. So some things have to change. When we first restored this tank, a modern fire suppression system was put in there by a company called Kiddy Gravner. Very grateful to them, because of the risk of a petrol engine of this age suddenly causing an engine fire. And historically, we know these things were not uncommon.
And you lose this incredible historic
exhibit. Yeah, so an engine fire, you might be able to rescue most of the vehicle, but it's still going to be a fairly damaging thing to happen. And it's not going to look good if that's on the media or the day you're driving it.
No.
So ultimately, we took that out, because it was very intrusive in the engine bay and other things we were doing. So I would argue there is no right or wrong answer, but you might want to ask yourself a better set of questions to give a product at the end or a set of answers that fit your establishment, what you're trying to achieve, yep. and what we are. If you're a private person, you do what you damn well like with it because it's yours, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
We are a public in essence. We're an independent charity. We're doing this on behalf of the Royal Armoured Corps. We're telling yep. their story, everything else that way. So we've got issues there that levels of expectation that if we, you know, decide we want to put a new engine in this to just so it runs around, there'll be loads of people saying, what a great idea, you know, the Tiger goes on running for another 5, another 10 years, let's put another engine in, it's good, it brings money. We're changing it. And we're changing it in ways that start eating into that level, not only of its originality that survived, but when that engine starts, does a Spitfire sound quite the same if actually we've got a modern MTU diesel that we'll get? You know what I mean? Everyone will be going, whoa, it's got to be a Merlin or a Griffin. You see what I mean?
Okay, so because you said earlier, I noticed your lecture you talked about, you were in the fine art world before.
Yeah.
Is it like restoring a painting?
Yeah, so where I disagree with an assumption a lot of funding bodies early on had real problems with 20th century mechanical or industrial heritage. What are we trying to save and how do we go about doing that in a sensible way? Now, fine art, the example might be a bit of sculpture or painting. It's almost like the aspiration is the day it left the artist's studio.
Yes.
Or we've flaked a couple bits up here. Let's yes. tie that in so the eye's not drawn away from it. So there's some things, and there's a huge convention that's built up over centuries of what you do to a work of art. 20th century mass-produced objects, what do? I've got another one of these wheel hubs. Let's bung that one on. We've done this and everything. So how much originality do you leave? And it's been an interesting, because the debate still goes on. There's people in the museum profession think we're complete cowboys for running Tiger 131, which is a kind of unique historical item. But when they close or fail, I'm not rubbing my hands together in glee, but I'm trying to say, actually, in the modern world, you've got to look at your circumstances. If you're centrally funded and money's not an option, or you've got a backer, actually, you might not have the same pressure on you to do something. We're an independent charity. We need bums on seats.
But the value in terms of bums on seats of this tank running,
it's been enormous to us.
You can't put a price on it, really, can you?
It's been enormous to us, and it's helped do what the original trustee's intention was, which is put the tank museum, help put it on the map.
Yeah.
So on one side that way, at the same argument is we don't want to go too far because if everyone just thinks you can whack an engine in the back of something that looks like a Tiger and drive it around and claim it's a Tiger, actually, where's the originality gone and the story and the issues?
See, I'd err on the side of keeping it running because it is Tiger 131 and we all know that. If it was up to me, but luckily I'm not in charge of a museum. In fact, and you're the last person, because I'd try and get them all going. I'd want them all running and you'd have a grand parade down to Poole or something and they'd all break down, obviously. But the original engine's over there, isn't it? The original power plant's over there. So what's in, which is a Maybach, isn't it?
So it's something they call a Maybach HL210 goes in the early production Tiger ones. Yeah. Ours is a very early production Tiger. That engine was taken out, we're not 100% certain when, but sectioned as a teaching aid for the military before this even comes here in 51. What we've ended up doing is putting a HL230, and the story behind it, we basically went through a number of different engines trying to either get one to work properly. We had a spare engine that was actually like, you know, one of these ones that was sat on a stand showing people what a HL230 looked like, probably from a Panther, we're not sure.
Yeah.
One had a twisted block. We've done a whole load of things. So the actual block that is in there at the moment that's running is actually a new old stock block that we were able to fit a lot of the original bits of running gear to, pistons, etc. And it's running. So what you're listening to is a World War II engine that was in a Tiger One. It wasn't in this Tiger One.
Right. How many hours to run this for now? How long do you run it for on Tiger Day tomorrow?
So we do, what we tend to do is we run the tank about twice a year.
Yep.
It's run up on the Wednesday before it goes out.
Yeah.
And the word in military terms is track mileage. We limit that track mileage.
Yes, of course.
So we don't wear it down too much unless we absolutely have to. And then whenever it runs, it's either got someone in or someone's paying us a bit of money to enjoy the day or doing whatever. So, you know, we're trying to milk it that way, unashamedly. So when it goes out, it tends to do, it'll be doing like a couple of laps, which I think will end up being like on the course by the time it's finished, probably a couple of kilometres maximum before it's coming back inside, having done that around that track out there. And we limit the number of, like when we were on the Fury set, it was all the arguments, how many gear changes, how long, how whatever. So we really try and do that. Within the same time, there is no point trying to start it up and do it all if you haven't let the engine get to the right temperature, if you haven't, you know, so you don't want to do it the wrong way, which is limiting in some areas, and the next minute you're wearing it out quicker by doing that.
Does it get the equivalent of the footballer's ice bath afterwards, you know?
It does. It has basically an oil change.
Right.
So, and it's put to bed. The way we do it in different ways, how it's put together and put to bed again afterwards, it's a lengthy process. In fact, we're just missing at this moment. Chris is actually dorking that startup procedure, how we go through all of that, just making damn sure everything's done in the right way and everything's recorded. So we write in a book because, again, the driver's told every time, if he hears a new rattle, stop. We'd rather investigate that
new
than
noise,
he just
fresh
keeps
rattle,
going. There's no radio in there to turn up and drown it out like you do in your car. So that's a very, you know, we want to know if there's something going wrong or the temperature gauge. They're always told, don't care if there are thousands of people watching, we'd much rather you pull over and we investigate than you just keep going because, oh, come on, it's a tank, let's push it. You know, it just doesn't work that way.
And how many spare engine blocks have you got? And how many spark plugs? And how many miles of wiring? And
we've been looking, we've been doing an inventory because I'm still amazed at what we do find. We have a backlog of storage issues. So we've got huge old stillages full of stuff that came down from the army. You know, sometimes it's 10, 15 years ago. We either had to take it at the time or it was dumped, you know. So we've never been able to go through. So it's really hard for us, hand on heart, to say we've only got the following because we were surprised ourselves to see how much we've got that we are looking at the moment, putting together a spare engine for this tank and looking at what's the prospects for the future. How long do we give it? Are other people going to be starting to cast new engine blocks? When do we start saying, almost your point, when do we start saying, do we try and keep originality by removing bits? But they can go back when the life of the running vehicle comes to an end, you see. So you're putting it back that
way. Turret, the turret
it does, but the issue with the vehicle, when it was hit, it's actually indented. So that lovely turret ring is not perfect. We have in the past actually recorded it rotating under its engine power, but we don't like doing that anymore because, to be honest, there's a couple of points you can tell it's struggling, which are pinch points from when it had the battle damage.
Because you wouldn't be able to drive it through this door with a turret sideways, would you?
Well, you have to turn. The interesting thing is, of course, we have to turn the turret sideways to lift the engine deck to go through the start procedure. So these are all these other wonderful things. So the you know, this is not a Le Mans quick start vehicle. You don't run across the road and jump in and press one button and off you go, which is, again,
shouting
on the war movies.
Panzer.
Exactly. Remember, these are, you know, 10 hours maintenance, 1 hour's driving.
Right, so that's your kind of ratio.
And that was wartime. You see, and that's what we sometimes forget about. These things, you know, they are the minute the thing stops, you'll see all the crews getting out with these oily rag and everything, going around greasing nipples, checking levels, doing everything with that. Because, again, one of my constant lines is a tank is not like your family car, but probably the nearest analogy we do is the car. You know, you jump in it, it's got an engine, it's going to drive.
That's what we're used to. That's how we're used to relating to vehicles, motor vehicles.
Is hugely labour intensive just to get that hours driving.
Why would I think I know the answer, but we've touched on it twice. There are only 1,300 of these. Why are there so few? Why did they build so few? Why did they not crack a proper mass production thing? Because in your lecture you show that the wheels are essentially being made in work. They're being made in workshops. They're not being made on a production line basis. So you end up with that thing that the parts don't match. That each Tiger is, although it has the appearance of a piece of mass produced military equipment, they're actually all individual and bespoke in a sense. And when you look at the riveting on a Spitfire, you know, the wartime riveting of a Spitfire, that's being done by Mavis at her own pace and her own distance, and it's not done uniformly and not the way we do it now. Well, obviously, you'd have a machine punching the holes. Why didn't they?
why weren't they able to turn it round, and why are there only 1,300?
Yeah, so the skill sets available in Germany, one of the things I was talking earlier is Hitler's fascinated by the motor industry. He loves the Henry Ford. He thinks his work practices, everything. He wants that Germany to copy that. The German motor industry is tiny in the early 30s when he comes to power. He goes to the motor show every year in Berlin because he wants to show the Nazi party's backing. He puts money into the Mercedes racing team, etc.
Yeah.
He famously backs Porsche for the people's car.
Although they only make one.
Exactly. So you pay all your Reichsmarks towards it as a people's car, but you don't actually get one because the war comes along in between. So there are a whole host of things that Hitler is trying to get Germany better at. But the truth is, the war has come early for the German military. They have a major issue in terms of production facilities, raw materials, and of course, oil and petrol.
Yes.
To actually keep the vehicles going. So there's one set of arguments that sometimes we're almost mocking the Germans. The propaganda gives us a view of the Stukas, the tanks racing forward, the sophisticated quick kit, but the rest of the German army is coming up way behind on its boot leather and with horse-drawn transport. Yeah. You know,
but it's like you can't fault their ambition in a sense, for want of a better way of putting it. But this tank is a good example of that because they were going to put a 75mm gun on, but it requires tungsten. They haven't got
They
haven't got the tungsten. The tungsten's too expensive. The wheels, as you said, they're all ever so slightly different.
Well, they're rubber coated, and they before the end of the Tiger I production, they have to go over to steel wheels because they haven't got enough rubber.
Yeah.
Even synthetic rubber, they can't make enough. So there is this dilemma that the Germans have of going for sophistication. But can they make, you see, you could argue, because they couldn't make mass-produced numbers, even if they were making simpler things, because they simply didn't have the raw materials or couldn't give enough petrol. So everyone says they should have made another 1,000 Stugs, but if they hadn't got the fuel for another 1,000 Stugs...
Which is demonstrated in their aircraft production. After all, the fighter production in 1944 is incredible, but there's no fuel, no pilots.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, well, slow hand clap. Well done, everyone. So you could argue in a way that they made the right amount of Tigers, because that's the amount of Tigers they could make.
It's a tricky one. So you've got arguments on both sides. Could you have made it more simple? Could you have done... They couldn't have followed the American or Russian model in those sheer numbers.
No.
Because they just didn't have the industrial backing or the raw materials to do it. At the same time, you do wonder, there's, you know, when Speer comes along and he's talking to Hitler, you know, one of the things they try and do is knock on the head these vanity products and this range of different types of vehicles, which they're all aware creates problems for themselves. And they are trying to learn from the Allies. You know, the Adolf Hitler tank program, Speer is getting Hitler to agree, we need to simplify. So the last model Panzer IV is made in a certain way to speed production and simplicity.
Yeah.
So those things are going on.
Yeah.
But to us from the outside, it just seems so ridiculous that the Germans are building things like a King Tiger, the biggest, thirstiest tank of the war, when they are running out of fuel and they're having to change the design of the wheels. So there's just a sausage of rubber pinched in the wheel to try and take the vibration out.
Just because they can't help themselves.
It's that peculiar dilemma. Although some would argue they probably did the right thing, because actually going for technology, if they can't go the other way, why not go top-end technology? It's an issue because it's so pertinent, you know...
Right
military
now.
Military background, Dad.
Right,
exactly
right
that.
Right this minute.
Absolutely. We're talking to the army about this. There is no point you having a Formula One of tanks if the driver is only capable of learning how on a Ford Transit and doesn't have the skill set to get the Formula One car going.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So why give them a really sophisticated bit of kit if there's too many things to go wrong, or they don't have enough training time or skills to get the best from it?
Yeah. Well, but then you also need a culture that's attuned to armoured warfare anyway, if you're going to build tanks and, you know...
Which, of course, we are in Britain, aren't we?
Well, I don't know, you know. I mean, this is the... great impetus.
Don't fall for it. We are still going to have tanks. We're going to do an upgrade on Challenger 2. That was all a bit of ankle showing of people trying to say, let's get the argument going beforehand. So
you heard it here first, folks.
You did. So we will
have
be getting
exclusive.
The upgraded Challenger 2.
With the gun from the Leopard on it.
So it's basically a 120. Ignore all this stuff about the 130 going on that RBSL have put out. That's just, again, a bit of fantasy stuff. That's not what the programme is. But that very tank is up the road from us as we speak. So it will happen. It just won't be enough numbers to make the slightest bit of difference in the future.
If should the balloon go up. Right. Yeah. Okay. One last question, because you've a busy day tomorrow. You're a busy day getting ready for tomorrow. And I can't tell you how much... I mean, I really would love to pick your brains actually all day on this and then be here tomorrow, but we can't do that. What happened to the Tigers? We know the history of this tank extremely well, sort of in intimate detail. It's probably the best recorded Tiger tank of the Second World War, isn't it? Down to the last nut and bolt. Although, interestingly, you don't really know where it was knocked out and where it was pinched quite. Sort of do, but don't quite, which I think is really, really interesting that something this well documented.
New history comes like all the time. Yeah.
But this is the nature of history after all, you uncover and think, oh, hang on a minute, they were the other way around after all. What happens to all the Tigers at the end of the Second World War? I mean, the Russians have got some, the Americans have taken some, stick them on ranges.
So there's one thing that it still fascinates me today, because sometimes you get people saying, oh, they did that, or we tell some story about here's one on the range being shot, and they all email in saying, oh, you know, the Philistines, why did they do this and everything? Well, number one, during the war, there was a war to win, so we just had to know how to beat the bastards first. So stop all this caterwailing as if, like, you know, they should about thinking about the games play or model makers of the modern era,
and they should
have saved more of them, shouldn't they? You know, we'll lose to fascist Germany, shall we? But just so that you've got a tank or two left over, so there was an absolute key issue.
Yeah,
they have to get on top of, first of all. The second thing is, I'll do the analogy now, so it's like Iraqi armor. So after the first Gulf War, huge amounts of kit came back. It was bombarded around the country, played with, done, you know, gate guards, everything. None of us give a monkeys about that at the moment, but there will be a point in the future where people say, that was an original Type 59 that was captured in Iraq.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? So at the moment, we don't give a monkeys. Now, if you're also in one of those countries that Tigers ended up in, so it's by the side of the road in France, this is a symbol of oppression.
Yes.
They were the invaders. Get that bloody thing out of my sight.
Yes.
All right? So one or two...
There's that King Tiger in the Ardennes, isn't there? And I've always sort of wondered about that, because I understand Sherman's as gate guardians or as memorials or centaurs or Cromwells or whatever all over Europe. I get that. But there is that Koenigstag, isn't there?
There's a Tiger 1 by the side of the road in Vimutier, Normandy.
Now, what's that all about?
That was pushed. It was pushed off the road, went down a bank, was hard for the scrap men to recover, but they did start cutting it up. And then by the mid-70s, they suddenly thought, well, hang on a second, this is now the level of interest is a different level, not scrap value, historical, isn't it good as a tourist thing, etc. So it's dragged up and put there. So sometimes you get these accidents of history why something was saved.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time you have to think about these are things that...
represent invasion and oppression.
Yeah, and they're also, if there's anything useful, let's go and use those wheels. You know, you go around the Ardennes, you find every other farmer's got track links to keep his gate closed, with weights and everything.
Yeah.
So let's use what we can, scrap the rest, get rid of it, and let's rebuild our society, because not everyone wants to remember there was Nazi tanks here, last year, 5 years. Yeah. Now we're all fascinated. We all want them. We all think they're the best things since sliced bread. Every games player, every model maker, every people interested. But interesting, we're not across that spectrum, you see, because tanks are big, iconic, sexy. How many people collect German wartime bicycles? An awful lot fewer, because they're not quite as woo, are they?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, certainly stood next to it is definitely plenty woo. David, thank you so much for talking to us. I hope tomorrow goes really well. And thank you again for your time today. It's just the most brilliant privilege to be able to come here, talk to the curator, pick his brains. He knows literally everything about this vehicle. But also to talk about what history is and how history shifts, You know, because there's been a lot of debate about history too. I mean, aside from
tank history, what are we saying it from? We're at the British Tank Museum in Bovington. We have a view from the British viewpoint, inevitably, and we're the Royal Armour Corps Museum. Yeah. You'll go to a different museum, different part of the world, different periods, etc. That history is going to change how you look at it.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by the fact that we're living through an era where the guys who did it are just dying out. How will history be rewritten when those blokes aren't quite around?
Yeah.
And I'm already, this is where we're acutely conscious here, already you've got people coming around, are you sure about this? Did the Holocaust, for example, really exist? Did you? Yeah. All of those things, which for me, it's just, if you've met the man, talk to them. We've got an interview over there with a guy who was at Belsen being liberated. Yeah. That, for him, what he says about it, and then the fact that at the moment in the world, there's people who quite happily come out and say, oh, that was just propaganda or something like that.
Well, and I've met the Rabbi Hardman who did the burials at Belsen. So, met him many years ago. The moment anyone starts with any of that, you think, no, I'm... Exactly. We just did a gesture then that you wouldn't have heard on the podcast. Again, David, thanks very much for talking to us.
No problem at all.
Total pleasure. Thank you.